Get your butt up the ladder. Tell Andy come see me.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services, Monday, April 28th. You know, we're almost through this month already. And we're hearing Senate Bill 5531, Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and just a couple of housekeeping items. The House hasn't, they must have been late getting out of session. They should be arriving soon. If there's anyone in the audience who has a cell phone, please turn it off so it doesn't disrupt the proceedings. And for individuals who haven't appeared before us before, we have a couple of very favorite entities with us. They're Rosie and Rosette. Those are the blue and pink pigs that are before you, and they're there as a way of finding individuals who use acronyms. And we try to discourage the alphabet soup, but at the same time, we encourage that you feed Rosie and Rosette, because at the end of session, the dollars will go to the Oregon Food Bank. With that, LFO has a couple of handout items, and I'll give Cindy the opportunity to explain those.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cindy Jones. In front of you, there is a packet of information, which is a high-level overview for the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. Inside, you'll find the purpose, its budget, revenue sources, and the factors that drive costs. This is a Medicaid match as 50% federal, 50% state and local funds, and the Older Americans Act fund is 75% federal, 25% state and local funds. There were no package enhancements to this budget. Let's see. The Long Care Ombudsman, they investigate and resolve complaints. The investigations actually involve problem-solving on behalf of residents. Any abuse complaints are referred to local adult protective services. They mediate and resolve disagreements and monitor long care and long-term care facilities. Their budget, other funds, 71% other funds. General fund is 29%. Revenue sources. The proposed budget, I have it broken down. Personal services was 52%. Services and supplies, 20%. Special payments, 28%. They have 8 positions. And on the back, I have my LFO write-up. It's a little bit more in-depth.
Okay. You have, why don't you pass out their priorities? And who's the staff? Meredith and George? Welcome, Meredith.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, how would you like to proceed? Would you like...
Well, actually, I'd like to proceed like we have done in the past and get the overview from Meredith and... Who's this, Meredith?
Kathy Walter, the program administrator.
Okay. And Kathy, so that we can walk through whatever documents Meredith has. And I see she came prepared.
Madam Chair, I hope I don't violate any of the rules of the committee, but I did come prepared. And just like Jimmy Carter, I may have acronyms in my heart, even if I don't state them. And therefore, I do want to contribute. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and as such, I direct the activities of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. And I'm here today with Kathy Walter, who's a jack of all trades for the agency, but she does technical budget preparation, and she handles all of our databases in the office. Also, there are two members of the Long-Term Care Advisory Committee that monitors the program, and that those members are Gene Williams and Bill Lichen, who is the vice chair, and you may hear from later this afternoon. The mission of the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman is to enhance the quality of life, improve the level of care, protect the individual's rights, and promote the dignity of each Oregon citizen housed in a long-term care facility. And for purposes of our agency and the work that we do, long-term care facilities are our nursing homes, adult foster care homes, residential care facilities, and assisted living facilities. The Federal Older Americans Act is the federal enabling legislation for the program, and it requires all states to carry out, through the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, a state long-term care ombudsman program. And the enabling legislation in the state is Oregon Revised Statute 441-100 through 153. The Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman is charged with both individual and system advocacy, and we have four program goals. One is to investigate, identify, and resolve complaints made by or on behalf of the residents of long-term care facilities. A second goal is to establish a routine presence in our long-term care facilities using a cadre of trained program volunteers. A third very important goal is to ensure that the consumers, the public, facility staff, and agencies are aware of the Ombudsman program and its services. And our last goal is to advocate for system-wide changes that promote and protect the interests of long-term care residents. All of the program activities are linked to the agency's mission and goals. The agency developed 13 performance measures that are tied to the four agency goals, and we seriously took into consideration the comments and the issues that were raised in our last budget hearing. I think then Representatives Winter and Schrader had significant input and challenged us to examine our output measures in an effort to make them into performance measures. And so we worked on them and submitted those measures to the Department of Administrative Services. We worked with them with staff and our advisory committee, and we met with after submitting them to the Performance Measure Review Committee, we met with Progress Board staff to review their feedback. I'd just like to read the summary of the committee's final review regarding those performance measures. The DAS Performance Measure Review Committee has reviewed the agency's 13 performance measures and finds that they meet all five basic criteria as specified in the performance measure guidelines. The measures are well aligned with four goals, a mission statement, and Oregon Benchmark Number 51, Elder Abuse. They represent a concise but comprehensive perspective of the agency's responsibilities. All have targets that appear to be ambitious but realistic. Data sources look good. The way that we evaluate the progress toward achieving performance measures is that we use data from our case and monthly reports that are submitted by the Ombudsman staff and volunteers. We do evaluation surveys of our certification program that's after it's been completed by participants, and we have numerous volunteer databases. And the agency's databases include the OnTrack computer program, which is used to collect data from the annual federal report, and it allows the agencies to use the data to evaluate our ombudsman facility coverage, our complaint data, and our volunteer and staff activity. And we use management reports to help us achieve those goals. And as you can see on page 7, we have a number of different management reports, including we track the facilities that are visited at least quarterly, the visit history by individual ombudsman volunteer, facility visit history by the district in the state, the type of facility, the program role. We have case detail reports. We track complaints by type of facility. We also monitor cases that are opened more than left open more than 30 days. We track cases requiring initial action and any other open cases. We looked at the volunteers' case histories and their status in the we monitor their status in the program. We monitor their need for assignment review, their continuing education history, their reporting compliance histories, and we also track the numerous applicants that come into our program for purposes of screening to become trainees in our program. We review trainee certification status, and we do detailed volunteer exit surveys of the program. And the organization of the agency is that we have 8 full-time equivalent staff and 280 volunteers that are organized around a single program. And because our services are very labor-intensive, the budget is developed to support the agency's volunteer workforce. So on page 9, we have the agency's organizational chart, and to the right side of that chart, where you will see the Deputy State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, we have 4 Deputy State Ombudsmen that each have a responsibility for supervising a part of the state and all of the volunteers and complaint activity in that particular part of the state. At the bottom of the chart, you'll see the number of facilities that the agency is responsible for monitoring and the facilities for which we provide ombudsman services. I should add at this time that the agency also has a small volunteer-run friendly visitor program that does not use any program resources to speak of. It's entirely voluntary-run in different regions of the state, and we have what are called screening and recruitment committees that actually do the interview of volunteer applicants into our program, and they also make the public aware of our services in their local communities. And some of them take on the responsibility also of volunteer programs that are run to provide one-on-one interaction between residents and citizens in the community. Basically, the agency's services, they're pretty simple, is that we do complaint investigations, we do problem resolution, we do monitoring of care standards, and we educate numerous constituencies about the long-term care system. And in order to do that and provide all those services, we recruit, train, certify, and support a statewide network of volunteers.
Meredith, would you, and I ask this question of seniors and people with disabilities because the agency also does investigation and does abuse follow up on elderly abuse and the disability population. Help me to distinguish what you do from what they do.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be most happy to. Senior Services does a lot of things, but in the area of adult protective services, they do investigations of abuse. And as adult protective services agencies, they are agents of the state. And they conduct formal investigations following mandated protocols and to determine whether the incident as alleged occurred, whether the resident or the residents need protection from further harm, and who is at fault. And that is what the Adult Protective Services units do. And we have them all over the state, and they respond in local communities. What the ombudsman does is quite different. We're not residents, we're not agents of the state, we're agents of the resident. And the ombudsman engages in objective fact-finding within a facility in order to resolve problems and advocate on behalf of the resident. And so it's a more informal, within the facility most often, means of problem resolution. If one were to think about anyone living in community and then thinking of someone who is very impaired and without relative power and influence in a community. There is no end to the number of problems that arise that are not abuse, but they interfere with people's quality of life and their well-being. And those are the problems that day in and day out we address in the program. When our volunteers and our staff do come to know about abuse, we refer those complaints to Adult Protective Services, for they are the primary respondent, and they are the ones who conduct those investigations. We have a further responsibility. I know this is probably more than you ever wanted to know, Senator Winters, but we have a further responsibility to monitor that investigation if a complainant asks us to. So after an Adult Protective Services investigation is conducted, if the complainant is unhappy with the results of the investigation, believes that material witnesses may not have been interviewed, or that there is evidence that was not considered, they sometimes come to our agency, at which case we will help them review the report, and we will make depending on the issue involved, we will ask that the particular investigation be reopened. So we have a monitoring function with respect to Adult Protective Services, but we are not the primary investigator.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gurley.
Is there another place where an independent review could also take place, independent review of an allegation of patient abuse?
Madam Chair, Senator Gurley, our office can, in fact, do an independent review if the facts of the case, you know, are compelling enough. So we could, in fact, we have the authority to look at records and do an independent review. The issue then, of course, becomes what happens with that independent review and whether or not the primary investigating agency or senior services would, in fact, take the results of that review and change their findings with respect to the particular case. Also, I've come to know that there have been occasions where complainants have approached senior services for a review or a reexamination of that case, and there have been occasions when the client care monitoring units that actually do the surveys, for example, of nursing facilities, with respect to nursing facility abuse, for example, they also have authority to conduct abuse investigations. And so that is an avenue that people have to have even someone else within the senior services do an investigation or a reinvestigation of an abuse case.
Sounds like it just sounds like a confusing system.
Madam Chair, Senator Gurley.
No, Senator Gurley. I've been trying to bring these pieces together and so that it's less confusing as it deals with who's responsible and who's doing what. Because on the one hand, you have the ombudsman activity, which then refers some of the cases to the state, the Senior and Disabled Services, who then in turn investigates. And so just trying to figure out how this all comes together and how the resolution all comes together. One is representing, as I understand what Meredith is saying, the patient's rights over here. The agency has the regulatory responsibility of conducting the investigation. And yet I do think that probably the ombudsman does and can do independent reviews.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. We can. And quite, you know, there are, in participating in the Governor's Task Force on the Future of Services to Seniors and People with Disabilities last year, I think we generally believe, it came to a conclusion that our system is easy to access but very difficult to navigate. And this is across a wide number of a large spectrum. And one of the roles of our agency in that process was to push more and more for more information to be available to consumers. A very worthwhile project that the Senior Services was working on and has sort of temporarily suspended in light of some of the budget exigencies was to actually develop a website that would put all of the abuse data on a website for people, including sanction data, abuse, substantiated abuse data, so that consumers would have better access to the information. A lot of the times we spend a lot of energy in our agency explaining to people what they can expect with respect to when they file an abuse with Adult Protective Services, what they can expect is the outcome, when they might get information, how long it might take, what we do for them in the event after they've received the report of investigation. But if one were looking at the Adult Protective Services system, I think that one of the recommendations of the governor's task force was that we needed to look at it pretty closely, and that, in fact, there were several recommendations in our subcommittee that came from that in terms of looking at definitions of abuse, looking at I think that and I'll just share with you, I think one of the recommendations was evaluate and revise the Adult Protective Services function of the state. Was one of the recommendations of the task force, and it included standardizing investigation procedures and timelines, increased staffing, and allocate to local areas more realistically, provide oversight to determine if interventions are timely and appropriate, and if local triage decisions are adequate. So there was a general consensus that we've got some issues that need examining in the system. And perhaps if this session hadn't taken the fiscal turn that it did, there might have been more attention directed to that particular aspect of the system in terms of reform. But your concerns are well taken, and it is something that we do need to pay some attention to in the future.
Is there any budgetary aside? Because I think there is the perception that the long-term care ombudsman actually conducts investigations. And is there any reason why your organization could not, as the independent entity, conduct some of those investigations? I guess, you know, I'm looking at where you're talking about independence on one hand, that where the system itself isn't evaluating itself. And you and I have talked about this before, so...
Madam Chair, you know, it's interesting because I have been brought to Washington, D.C. This was a long time ago and several years back, but there have been major meetings at both the federal levels and the state levels to distinguish between Adult Protective Services and Ombudsman Services. And the general thinking is there were some Ombudsman programs, for example, in times past that were doing Adult Protective Services functions, and those have been eliminated. I think Connecticut was the last state that was actually doing. And there has been a real effort to maintain the integrity of what the Ombudsman program does, which is really being an advocate for the resident, to use facts to be an advocate rather than to do a protective services function, which is all about discerning harm and removing people from harm's way. There's been a real distinction made between the two programs at the federal level, and there hasn't been an inclination in any way to merge those two functions, and in fact it's been the opposite way, to look at ways of clarifying and making the two functions more distinct. Part of the reason, Madam Chair, is that Adult Protective Services and abuse is one finite area. But the range of problems that people find themselves in long-term care facilities, whether it be a good facility or a bad facility, they're just innumerable how many different kinds of problems people can get can find themselves into that need resolution. And quite frankly, our resources are stretched just handling that range of problems from, you know, people who have their wheelchairs turn up lost, they lose their dentures and other personal property, all sorts of things that contribute to the quality of their life but have very little to do with actual abuse as that definition is put forward in our laws and our rules.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burley.
Thank you. Again, just wanting to better understand the distinction between the two functions. Is it not accurate then to say that a function of Adult Protective Services is also to be an advocate for a resident?
I don't believe, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, I don't think that they view their function in that way. To the extent that they find a resident has been harmed, and to the extent that they have to remove that resident from harm's way, one would look at that in part perhaps as an advocacy function. But more important, it represents the parens patriae role of the state to protect people and to protect people from harm. And it's a very, very discreet function with mandated procedures and protocols, far different from ours, which is, again, to find out what the facts are in a situation and to try to facilitate the resident's own decision-making about whatever the issue is. If the resident uses us as their eyes, their ears, in order to advocate for things that are important to them and meaningful to them in their lives, which is just a qualitatively different, usually, function than the more protective services function. The other part of it is, Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, is that when you get into the area of abuse investigation, you really need trained investigators, and you need people who can put a report together and put a report in such a way that it can withstand legal scrutiny if challenged. Because if a provider, for example, has a finding of abuse, and they have a sanction, a fine, that results from that finding, they will invariably challenge that finding. So you have to have a report written by trained people in such a way that the report can withstand that kind of legal scrutiny. The Ombudsman Program, we train volunteers, and I believe we do a very good job of training our volunteers, but these are citizens in their community, and I really need to tell you, and you can ask the ones that are here, that report writing and the production of paper is not why they join the Ombudsman Program. The reason they join is to have that direct link with people, to promote their well-being, to respond to their concerns, and try to make their days a little bit better.
That's okay.
Yeah. You know, it may be that it's the semantics of the terminology that's in the way, because when one thinks in terms of an investigator, they think in different terminologies than if one is thinking in terms of an advocacy function. Mm-hmm. And that may be what's causing the confusion, because what you're stating is, in fact, it is not investigatory kinds of activity. It's advocating on behalf of an individual for some kind of a change or to help them facilitate something.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, your questions are all extremely well taken, and your confusion mirrors the confusion of many people in the system, and I think that we have to do a better job of helping people to understand what the distinctions are and what they can expect from the various agencies who do this kind of work.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burley.
I think examples are always helpful. So, for example, if you could provide an example of where the advocacy role may need to hand off to the Adult Protective Services role, or vice versa. Do you have an example that comes to mind?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, let me just provide you a few examples that I brought here today of some ombudsman work to sort of here's one that we recently worked on. The staff of a residential care facility left a resident's wheelchair outside. The wheelchair was ruined in the rain and then lost. That left the resident confined to to bed. That's where the ombudsman found the resident. The ombudsman stepped in. The wheelchair was found, repaired, and returned to the resident. You know, whether that does not meet the legal definition of abuse, but you can just imagine how that affected the quality of life of that resident to have the one thing that ensured their ability to ambulate around the facility disappear. Those are the kinds of things. We have numerous food complaints, for example, in particularly in assisted living facilities. And sometimes what the ombudsman does in order to try to respond to those, they don't rise to the occasion of abuse, but you've got residents unhappy all over the place. Ombudsmen take various approaches to those kinds of complaints. Sometimes we establish a food committee within the facility in order to give a concerted input to the facility in terms of the needs, wants, and desires of the residents in terms of food. There was a situation recently where the daughter of a residential care facility was concerned because her mother wasn't receiving the nutritional supplements that were ordered to help with the feed, or if she wasn't receiving help with feeding. Now, it hadn't gotten to the level of abuse where the resident was losing weight, so there was not the harm that is involved in abuse. So what the daughter was considering hiring an out-of-pocket an aide to be a presence in the home in order to ensure that these functions happen. And then what the ombudsman did is they intervened with the facility, they corrected the problems, and without the need of this family having to incur the cost of bringing an aide into the facility at a cost to the family, which would have been probably rather excruciating.
Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. But Madam Chair and Senator Gordley, day in and day out, there is no end. All I can tell you is there's absolutely no end to the fact patterns that present themselves that compromise people's well-being when they live in community. And that's what we're there. The volunteers are foot soldiers in those facilities trying to form relationships with those residents in order that the residents feel comfortable and secure in conveying the things that are most meaningful to them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's your winners.
Director Smith.
Thank you. How do you balance negligence with ineptness or immaturity of providers? You mentioned the wheelchair left out in the rain. I guess I could just visualize one of my boys leaving a wheelchair out in the rain, and no negligence was met. But
they're pretty young.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking, what about, how do you balance that?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, well, negligence is a legal concept, and but the fact of the matter is, there was really no need to balance that because all you wanted to do in this situation was get the problem addressed as soon as possible. So it wasn't about excoriating the aide who might have done that, although you would hope that they would be more conscious the next time around. It was about locating the chair, getting it fixed, and getting it back to the resident as soon as possible. So that kind of informal problem resolution that goes on in the facilities isn't about forming necessarily a record of blame or negligence. It really is about getting the job done for the resident in the most timely and efficacious way as possible.
Thank you. That's actually what I wanted to hear. Thank you.
The agency budget includes the services of problem resolution and complaint investigations in one basic level decision unit, and we've gone over some of the functions, but beyond investigating and resolving complaints, one is to establish a community presence in long-term care facilities. We provide consultations, technical assistance, and education to numerous entities in the long-term care system, including families, facility staff, agencies, guardians, conservators, hospital discharge planners, advocates, and other individuals regarding long-term care issues. And we inform policymakers and community organizations and provider groups about the issues and problems of long-term care facility residents. We monitor the laws, the rules, and the regulations that govern long-term care facility. And most important, we serve as the voice of the resident in public policy forums, and we advocate for changes that protect their rights and interests. The basic major budget issue of the agency is the need for paid staff to support the volunteer effort. And we've revised our strategic business plan, and what we're going to focus on is maximizing the agency's ability to advocate on behalf of a growing population of long-term care facility residents by focusing on our newly developed performance measures and further defining the steps that will enable the agency to achieve each of the annual targets set in the development of the measures. We're always tinkering with the long-term care ombudsman program in an effort to increase its efficiency and its ability to respond to the citizens of Oregon. And we did a significant program realignment in 1995 and 97 in order to accomplish those goals. And the other part of it was we were very conscious of maximizing our ability to have agency staff in the field working with the volunteers and investigating complaints. So all of the professional staff members of the agency except the director have direct field supervisory responsibility. Another big change that happened in the program in 1995 is that the federal government created a comprehensive database. It was an effort to create a database on the nation's long-term care ombudsman programs. And so the Federal Administration on Aging overhauled the reporting requirements for all state long-term care ombudsman programs. And that has significantly increased the amount of time we spend on data collection and entry. And this unfunded mandate requires a considerable amount of staff time each week, additional computer and software systems, and we even need an outside provider for software maintenance in the agency that prior to that time we did not have to do. We try very hard in the agency, and I know Chair Winters has laughed sometimes when I said this, but we have tried very, very hard to affect cost efficiencies in the agency, because I know why she laughs is because she hears it from everybody. But let me just say, I really believe that we make an effort. The first efficiency, of course, is that we have 183 certified volunteer ombudsmen, and they provide a direct service to Oregonians and communities throughout the state. And
Meredith, how many communities do not participate in the ombudsman program?
Well, Madam Chair, first of all communities participate. There are a few communities that at various points in time may not have volunteers. We still put our staff in those communities. And if you return to the appendix, you will see that there is a statewide, Appendix C is a statewide distribution of volunteers and facilities. And at this point in time, what you'll see is there are a few areas where we do not have a volunteer presence, and that right now is Klamath Lake. Two of our ombudsmen from the Klamath area recently resigned, and we also do not have volunteers in Harney or Malheur. We do send staff Every other month, we do send staff out to those places where we do not have volunteer ombudsmen in order to do some facility monitoring, as well as to respond to any complaints or concerns that we've received in those areas. So beyond the other thing that you ought to know about the certified ombudsman is that they're accessible on nights and weekends. And that's a service that's not provided by most governmental agencies. And many of our volunteers get calls in their homes, some, much to their consternation, at all hours of the night. And why I say that is sometimes some of our volunteers are beleaguered by 2 a.m. calls. But we always find a way of responding to the calls that come in. And the volunteers, we calculated, contributed 22,795 hours of service in 2002. Those are the certified ombudsmen only who are in the facilities throughout Oregon. The other cost efficiency that the agency has is that we rent space at $1.16 per square foot. The standard state rate for office space is $1.30 per square foot. So we stayed over in the northeast corner of Salem in an effort to be cheap. We also conduct meetings all over the state throughout the year to support our volunteers. And in the 2002, we conducted 219 meetings. All of them were in free space that we identified throughout the state. The other big thing is that our volunteers are not routinely provided with mileage reimbursement to go to their facilities. Some of them do access some mileage reimbursement through RSVP and others, but the majority do not have reimbursement for mileage. We reimburse our volunteers for the required training to be a certified ombudsman and their required continuing education, but we reimburse on a scale of between 20 and 30 cents a mile and not the standard rate. And we do have a long-term care advisory committee, as I indicated, and they keep their expenses down to about under $500 a month. And we make cost a primary consideration in practically all of our supply and in all of our supply and purchasing decisions. So we really have made an effort to think about costs and taxpayers' pocketbooks as we run this program. In terms of coordination with related programs, I've already spent some time talking about our relationship to Adult Protective Services. And the agency anticipates spending approximately 94% of its total operating funds on program activities. And the administrative functions of the agency include primarily the state government service charge, as well as human resources, accounting, and some budgeting. In terms of information technology, we basically rely on our computer system to track and monitor most of our program functions. And I've summarized some of the databases that we have in the program, and we basically track each case that comes to the agency. We manage information about all of the volunteers in the program, and we collect a large amount of data that is required by the Federal Administration on Aging every year in terms of reporting to the federal government. And we use email as a constant source of communication and a growing source of communication with our volunteers. Although our databases are not directly linked to any other agency, we are connected to the state's network. We don't have any plans to upgrade our computer system in the next biennium. And we have only one IT contract, which I referred to earlier, and that's the only service provider who's authorized to maintain the data collection software package that we use for the federal government reporting. And We have a website that's currently in development, and what we're hoping to do is, as soon as that, we're coordinating that with the DAS website development act that's going on, and what we hope to do is put all of our program data regularly on the website so it is accessible to whomever, whenever they may need it.
Madam Chair.
Senator Gorley.
Thank you. I'd like to go back to the information on your program volunteers and how they're being managed. It looks like you have 280 program volunteers currently, which is wonderful, and then another 250 to 300 individuals who apply annually. That suggests that there's a waiting list.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, there's sort of a whittling process that happens. We have a lot of people that apply to the program. We have a lot of people that drop out once they find how rigorous the activity and the demands of the volunteer role. We have people that apply for more than just being the certified ombudsman role. We have, as I referred to earlier, we have in localities throughout the state, we have recruitment and screening committees, and we also have volunteer-friendly visitors. And so basically in our process, in our program, we have a lot of people that apply. Then we have the people that actually will either go through the training, identify for one role or another. And then through the training, there's a further winnowing process. And I think I refer that more specifically in the fuller agency presentation. But people don't always make it through the training. People decide to leave in the training. People don't always pass the certification exam in order to be certified as an ombudsman program volunteer. So it's all we have a large number of applicants for a large number of roles, and just depending on whether people stick with it or not, or how they direct their energies, will determine who ultimately ends up in the program.
Well, let me ask the question differently. Do you have the capacity to manage all of the volunteers who desire to work with this program?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, the answer is yes. We have, it's interesting because volunteerism in the last several years has changed. The complexion of volunteerism has changed. And a lot of volunteers, and I guess it's appropriate that we talk about this since this is, I guess, National Volunteer Week, but a lot of volunteers look at a more episodic, short-term volunteer activity now. Ours is a more, we definitely, the average length of stay in our program now is about 29 months for a volunteer. So we look at a volunteer for a longer term. And so we have to actively recruit volunteers for the program. And over the last several years, we formed a partnership with the AARP. And the AARP uses its membership and its mailing list to help us target zip codes and various places in the state where we need volunteers in order to have those volunteers come to us in terms of their interest in wanting to fill out an application and go through all the process that it takes to become a volunteer. So in answer to your question, it's a balance. We have, in terms of certified ombudsmen, we have, through a process of analysis, we have come to know that with current staff, we can basically maintain a level of about 180, give or take, certified ombudsman volunteers in order to support them, train them, provide technical assistance, and motivate them. And we find that it is still an effort to ensure that we maintain those levels. So it's not like everybody is beating down the doors to do this kind of work, because it is extremely challenging, and you have to be very, very comfortable with the notion of conflict as a positive concept. and not everybody is comfortable with that. And it is for that reason that we developed the sort of friendly visitor role, because it allows people in their communities who may not want to take on the more vigorous role of a certified ombudsman but still want to have contact with people in long-term care facilities. And it's proven to serve as have a very big therapeutic value. And so we have supported using volunteers in that way as well.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so then your ability to manage the volunteers and in a manner that ensures the quality of service isn't stretched, given that you have, at the top, you've got 8 staff, and then another level of volunteers providing support for the overall 280 program volunteers. You're not stretched.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, this is how the Institute of Medicine studied the long-term care ombudsman program. The U.S. Congress asked them to study the program, and in 1995 they wrote a report on their evaluation. What their recommendation at the time was that there should be the ideal ratio of staff to volunteer ombudsmen was 1-20. And at that time, they said that there was a possibility that the extreme would be a 1-40 ratio. At this point in time, we maintain a ratio of about 1-46. And so we are up a little beyond what the Institute of Medicine recommended. But we have been working with this since about the mid-90s, when we had many, many more volunteers. And we have sort of right-sized the agency at this point in time. And at the time that that Institute of Medicine study came out, we also did a study of our own program volunteers, and we evaluated their needs for support, technical assistance. One of the things that we do is we have a staff member on duty every day of the week just to take calls from, not only to do complaint intake, but to take calls from volunteers who are out in the field and they are encountering a problem they've never seen before and they need technical assistance. And so so what we did is we examined what their needs were. We got feedback from them and we sort of right-sized the organization. In 1999, with the help of AARP, we again took another stab at it, and we brought a whole lot more people into the program, and I think we had gotten over 200 volunteers, about 208 volunteers. And at the time, in our budget document, we said we don't know with current staff whether we can maintain this number. And we couldn't. So we've plateaued at about 180 for the staff that we have, and that looks like a very workable ratio for us.
180 or 280?
180 is the number of certified ombudsmen. We have other people in the program that are doing other roles, which are like our recruitment and screening and our friendly visitor volunteers. But the essential relationship in our program is between the paid staff and the volunteers that are in the facilities doing complaint, identification, investigation, and resolution.
Well, Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Well, what I'm hearing is a somewhat confusing message. I hear you saying that at a ratio of 1-46, you're above the Institute of Medicine standard. But you're not. But you don't describe this situation as jeopardizing your capacity to provide support that your volunteers need, and then also to ensure the quality of services that the volunteers are providing out there as advocates. I'm just wondering, how are you doing all this great work with so few people and all these volunteers who need support?
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, if the truth be known, I'm a taskmaster, and And we have tried over the years not to let the budget be the excuse for not doing for the citizens of Oregon. We really make a concerted effort in that area. So, yes, we are stretched. If you ask any of my staff, they will say, you know, we're working at capacity. And so it would be nice to have more staff. If we had more staff, then we could have more we could serve more volunteers who then could serve more residents in the facilities. I mean, that's the essential conundrum.
Stop right there. And I don't mean to be, I don't want you to take that in, as me being rude to you. All we need you to be before this committee is forthright. So if you're stretched, you're stretched. If you're beyond your capacity, you're beyond your capacity. Just tell us what the facts are, you know, and then that's helpful. It's helpful to me from where I'm sitting to really understand what your situation is out there, understanding the budget constraints and all of that, because you moved from telling me that you're not stretched to finally saying, yeah, we are. Okay.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, when I came into this program in 1989, the first thing I did was a program evaluation. Pursuant to that, I said, we don't have enough field staff to, at that time, the volunteers were training one another. There was no concerted training effort that was assured consistency throughout the state, and I said we need double the people in the field that we have. Well, we're now sitting here in 2003, and our staff hasn't increased except for one person. We added Ms. Walters in 1990, and so our staff hasn't increased. At that time, there were 28,000 beds. There are now 42,000 beds. What we have done with our model is we have tried and developed policies to maximize our ability to do the most we can for people with the resources that we have. But I would be foolhardy to tell you here that we couldn't do a lot more with more staff. I absolutely would be. And if the truth be known, and this is something that we were going to get to a little bit later, is that we have in Oregon one of the lowest staffing of ombudsman programs in the nation. We have something like, I think we were number 23 in the number of beds, but we're 40 in the funding of our long-term care facility, our long-term care ombudsman program per bed. So if you look at on page 68 of the presentation, and you look at the kinds of the values that Oregon has with respect to costs, and if you're looking at that chart, as you can see, we're 23rd in the number of long-term care facility beds, and we're 29th in total funding for our ombudsman program. And this was using data from the period of October 2000 to 2001, and it's reported through the Federal Administration on Aging. And the funding of our program, we fund our ombudsman program at $17 per long-term care facility bed, and we're 40th in the nation in terms of our funding. We're 17th in terms of the number of complaints we handle during that same period. The number of certified volunteers, at that time we had 178, and we were 15th in the nation in terms of total number of volunteers.
Meredith, in comparison and with your national, with Oregon's national ranking, and also looking at our neighboring state, Washington, is the responsibilities inside of the office the same?
Madam Chair, the essential functions of the program don't change from state to state, although different programs take on the two aspects of individual complaint resolution and system advocacy do change from state to state. But what's interesting in Washington when we did this is that they report to have 460 volunteers, and I could only dream of a workforce that large and what, you know, what we could do here in Oregon with that. And it just, I think what's the way Washington State is organized is that they have a central ombudsman office, and then they have regional offices where they have staff in those regional offices throughout the state. We don't have any regional offices. We're a centralized office, and we deploy from Salem. And that saves a lot of dollars for the state, but it does make it more challenging to connect with the facilities and our volunteers.
Madam Chair.
Reverend Wessler.
Just for the record, I appreciate the witness's long and articulate and correct description and answer to Senator Gordley's question, but for the record, I think she said they are stretched.
Mm-hmm. she was trying to say it in a much more kinder, gentler way.
She was very PC in that, but for the record, they're stretched.
But and nobody's ever accused Senator Representative Westland of being PC.
but I would like I would like to comment that I do like Ms. Walter's glasses. I think those are great.
May we proceed with these hearings?
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, I like her glasses as well. They're a constant source of amusement in the office. I guess we are stretched, but we're not willing to cry uncle. And the volunteers add an amazing dimension to the program. The agency is not sponsoring any budget-related policy legislation. And a review of the Department of Administrative Services Affirmative Action Progress Report shows that the agency has a high overall female 78% representation throughout the small agency. But currently there are no persons of color or persons with disability among the 8 full-time equivalent staff.
Is there any persons of color disability as volunteers?
Madam Chair, yes, there are. And historically, there have been. I do not have a count at this time. But one of the things that we do among our volunteers as well is we use the zip codes and along with AARP to be able to target some of our recruiting to areas that would allow us to acquire a more diverse workforce among our volunteers. Basically,
well, I will ask you, because I know it's going to get asked someplace, if you would provide us with the information on how many people of color do you have as volunteers, and on average, how long have they been volunteers?
Certainly.
Madam
Chair, historically, we've had little turnover in this biennium in terms of achieving any affirmative action goals. But historically, when filling openings in the agency, we always recruit in publications that reach target groups. And we are very, very conscious of ensuring that we interview people that have indicated that they are among those target groups. And that ends my rather lengthy overview, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I'll try and make this fairly quick. I am George Naughton with Budget and Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services. This is the handout that I'll be working off of, and it should be fairly quick. If you turn to the second page, you'll see that this budget, unlike what we've seen in the last several months or two, is a budget that's fairly small, just over $500,000 of general fund, and you'll see there that's about $2 million of total funds. The one thing I'll note right off the bat is that this, for the size of this budget, is a very complicated technical budget to walk through, and I'm hoping we won't spend too much time doing that. It's complicated for two reasons.
Just a moment. Mm-hmm. One of my members want to go back, George, to the overview. And he has some questions, so Representative Bates, go ahead and ask it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry you kind of, George, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you kind of caught me by surprise at sort of stopping, and I didn't want to jump ahead of the questions that I'd seen by reading ahead. our delivery system in Oregon is quite different than other states as far as our care for the elderly. We have a lot of foster homes, and we have adult foster homes and residential care facilities, and then we have extended care facilities, and we have, in other words, nursing homes. Per our population, they are quite a small number compared to the states, and Oregon is looked at as a state that's been very innovative and done an exceptional job in this area. What concerns me about this is my own perception is that you are more than stretched. And my perception is, according to the data I see here, what I see in my personal life is that most foster homes practically never get an ombudsman visit. It just doesn't happen. And because you haven't enough people. And I would also think that when you're dealing with a foster home, while I'm sure the vast majority do a wonderful job, those are very isolated people there, two, three, four people in a home. They may not have a lot of relatives visiting like they do in extended care facilities. I'm just wondering, you know, how we get to having opportunity to see how those people are doing. If there was abuse or a problem going on, it might go a long time before anybody would note it. And I just don't see how you can take the number of volunteers you have and go out to 2,000 or 3,000. I don't know how many foster homes there are, but I would guess a couple thousand in the state. How you actually get out to those homes on a regular basis and have a visit.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I guess I would say bingo. You're absolutely right. In the early 90s, when I first came into this program, the legislature said to me, they were basically in Oregon, we had nursing homes and we had foster care. We didn't, because foster care was a product and grew up through the 80s. We didn't have assisted living and we had very few residential care. The legislature said to us, get into foster care, which we did. And at that time and in the early 90s, that was a time when we identified numerous problems throughout the foster care system that led to much system reform, and I believe that we have a much better foster care system now than we did in the early 90s. But what happened in the mid-90s is assisted living and residential care development just took off. And so what happened when we found ourselves in the Ombudsman Program, our agency has always been a bellwether in terms of quality of care in the state. Because we have a statewide purview, we have always been an agency that knew before the regulatory agency where the problems were rather than having a system with a lot of local entities, we were a centralized operation. So all of the information was coming to one place, and I could look at it and examine it and say, whoa, we've got problems. Well, what happened in the mid-90s when assisted living took off is I had to take those volunteers that were all in foster care and say, we've got to get into assisted living and see what's going on. And sure enough, we had lots of problems at that time in assisted living that had to be addressed. And so what's happened in the ensuing years is assisted living and residential care has continued to explode. It continues to grow. And given their choices, our volunteers would rather operate in other environments besides foster care, because foster care is a much more difficult environment in which to advocate. And so what's happened is that we saw our numbers in foster care plummet because we were in all the other kinds of facilities and maintaining a presence. What we did last year is one of the requirements now is that everybody has to take on a couple of foster care assignments no matter what their other assignments are. And we've also experimented with monitoring roles, foster care monitoring roles, so some ombudsmen just specialize in doing nothing but adult foster care home visits. But yes, it is an enormous, we're very, very cognizant of the need to get in them. We've put into place all sorts of plans to be able to establish a presence there, but you're absolutely right. It has diminished over the 90s because of the need to be in other areas as well.
I think that has caused, and it's caused me some concern, and it's caused others some concern as to whether or not one of your major roles as an ombudsman is, quote, your bellwether and your advocacy activities. And if you're not able, you know, if for fiscal constraints or what other constraints, that you're not able to adequately perform that, it does cause some concern. You know, one of the, I think you and I have talked about, looking at when we come into, when the legislature convenes, that hopefully it's the long-term care ombudsman, based on the work that you've done, you know, through this interim period, that alerts us to some of those trends and give us those insights that we would may not get back from other entities. You, to me, are the balance, you know, and a critical balance in when we talk about the long-term care services. I think we're all raising this because we are concerned. We were concerned when we had senior and disabled services before us, and we saw the growing abuse, if you will. And I think we sat here and we were very alarmed. And how do we, as policymakers, deal with that issue? So it's an issue that we share your concern. And we're going to have to grapple with how do we make this work, because we are concerned that whether we're talking about adult foster care, assisted living facilities, or the nursing home facilities, that we're not putting seniors in a position of at risk and not getting the information back to us that we need in order to respond in a very positive way as it deals with these issues. And so that's why we're raising all this. Senator Shields.
I appreciate the direction of the discussion. First a comment and then a question, and the comment would be that if these folks at any point can't do the advocacy or be the bellwether we want them to be, it's probably our fault because we have limited their resources to do that. But my question is that in the early years of my days in the House, I got involved in introducing and being involved with an elder abuse law, which needed some updating. And yet, as I think back on that, that's been almost a decade now, too, maybe 8 years or so. Given the expanding kind of role that you have you seen or is there a need to look at elder abuse statutes in any way at this point in time?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, absolutely. One of the things that we have to deal with, just in terms of statutory, is that we have a different definition of abuse for every long-term care facility. Now, what we have to do is, I think it's time to re-examine that. Is there a reason why we need to have different definitions of abuse for every long-term care facility? There may be. But what that does is it makes it more difficult and challenging to inform people about what abuse is, to train people on how to investigate abuse, because you have different standards in different types of facilities. So, yes, and quite frankly, we have a nursing home abuse law in the statute, and then we have what's a community abuse law for people 65 and older, and then the rest of abuse is via regulation in individual facility rules and regs. Absolutely. If we want to look at abuse and take it seriously, I think we've got to devote some time and attention to it.
Just something else on their plate.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Last question. I want to make it perfectly clear that I'm very supportive of the work you do and your very limited budget, in that doing what you do is really kind of amazing, as you do with a volunteer base with very poor support from the state. So I don't want to say any negative connotation to it, but I want to go back to the adult foster care homes because I am concerned. Your own statistics show that you're visiting them on a quarterly basis, only 1.5%. Do most of them receive at least an annual visit, do you think you get to that level?
I don't know that. We could, Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we could give that to you. Kathy, do you have just the total facility visit, a chart that would help them? Help me, and then if you could pass that out to committee members. What I'm going to show you, Representative Bates, is this, is that we have adopted what we think is a very challenging performance measures, which are quarterly visits to each facility. But at the same time, we also have a lot of activity in facilities. We could have a facility, for example, that we were doing weekly visits in for three quarters of the year and wouldn't make, and one quarter, for some reason, the volunteer went on vacation, and we wouldn't make the chart of quarterly visits. So we have a lot of visitation activity, and I think what's the total visits in a year is about 13,000 facility visits in the period from October 1 of September 02. So we're and in that time in the adult foster care arena, we did approximately 2,600 adult foster care home visits during that time, during that year. Many of them just didn't fall in the quarterly visitation. The reason why we've adopted the quarterly visitation is because the Administration on Aging is, we believe, is going to start developing some standards for long-term care ombudsmen. And I think that they're going to use quarterly visitations as their standard. I think they're also going to get into other things about time frames for investigation, and we tried to jump the gun on all of those in our performance measures.
Meredith, a question on the investigation and the trying to jump the gun on the federal government. Since most of the investigation, you refer to protective services, how will that impact what their timetable would be?
What Kathy is looking for, Madam Chair, is a chart just to show you. We only refer a very small percentage of our cases to adult protective services, and just the pie chart that shows the referral. And so about 77% of our cases are actually not referred. They're worked on and resolved by the ombudsman themselves. And so do you have a pie chart that shows percentage of the complaints?
You can give the information back to us in some later day, but it would be very helpful to have, those that are resolved without being referred over to protective services, mm-hmm. and those that you'd have to track because you sent them to protective services.
We should have all of those, and this is how what Kathy just presented for you is just to show you in the period from 2001 to September 2002 the total number of cases that we referred to adult protective services, and of the total number. We referred 263 cases in our agency. And as you might imagine, when you look at our data on time frames for response, when we do refer things to protective services, the response time that we record for purposes of the federal government puts us out very frequently hundreds of days versus one of our program goals in our own cases is trying to wrap them up within 30. So the bringing in protective services into a case via referral does significantly expand the length of time into which we have a response that we can determine whether the complaint has been verified or not.
Are they having that discussion federally? Because if other agencies also have another agency that's doing the investigation under protective services, and then they're going to require a shorter timeline for completion, I would think that all the data would be skewed. A lot of the data would be skewed because you're being penalized for something that's happening over someplace else if you have no control.
Madam Chair, the federal government, I don't think right now asks us for our response time to complaints, but we have just been keeping that because we think it's important to know. So if you look at in the back of the document.
Oh, I guess I misunderstood you. Because I understood you to say that you're getting the jump over your federal agency because they may be in the future requiring some timeline.
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. In the future, they may be. Right now, they're not requiring it. They're just talking about requiring it. So that's why we built it into our performance measures. That's why we've begun to track it so that we can get an understanding of how long it takes to resolve certain complaints. But if you look at Appendix D, where we have one of the things that we – in Appendix D that we show you is that if you look at the top of the page on Appendix D, page 2, and there are several categories of abuse, And you'll see that the response time on many of those days, for example, physical abuse, average days until case closed, 162 days. That's because our agency is waiting for the Adult Protective Services report to be completed with respect to that. So all of those that reflect abuse, those time frames are, in fact, time frames that are not our own. They're based on the response time of Adult Protective Services.
Everybody, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What does gross neglect mean?
Gross neglect is a situation, for example, that you could find a resident. You find them in their bed. They have decubitus ulcers, pressure sores over their body, dehydrated, near death. But yet, there is not then a physical abuse perpetrated on them. They have been neglected. Their care has been neglected such that their physical being is jeopardized.
It's where patients haven't been turned and
cleaned,
and it's pretty gross.
It's amazing.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Winters. I'm actually surprised by how low the number of total complaints is on the handout that was provided. How do you go about informing the public of, is there a hotline number? How do folks know how to get a hold of
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, that's not the total of complaints on that particular handout. That was just abuse complaints that primarily referred to senior and disabled services.
Oh.
The total number of complaints is closer to about 5,000. For the period of the chart on Appendix C, the total number was 5,243. So there's lots of sort of the non-abuse, which is, you know, the substance of what we do.
Can you share with me how does the public go about finding you folks if they have a concern?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, there are many ways. First of all, by law, every facility has to post a poster within the facility in conspicuous locations throughout, in which they, and we actually send the posters to the facility. We identify our toll-free phone number on the poster, and we also indicate the name and the local phone number of the volunteer that is assigned to that facility. If there's not a volunteer assigned, then we just have the toll-free number for the state office. We also do, beyond that and the toll-free number, we do a lot of, the recruitment and screening committees do a lot of activities in their community, calculated, you know, whether it be conferences, fairs, whatever, but information activities calculated to make people aware of their services. We also use other organizations like the Alzheimer's Association and AARP, and then we use the media as well. We have a lot of public interest stories, which we find generate a lot of interest in the program and awareness of its services.
One last quick follow-up. Do you also do the reverse, and that is publicly highlight those facilities that do a great job?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, you know, it's harder to know a good facility than it is to know a bad facility. And it's an interesting thing, but one of the things is that we are a complaint-based organization. So to the extent that we hear nothing about a facility, one might assume that the reason you hear nothing is because everything is good. That may not necessarily be the case. So we don't feel as well equipped to, you know, we could advertise or talk about aspects of a particular facility that happen to be working well. The other thing about why it gets a little dangerous is that facilities can change on a dime. In a foster care, for example, the very care depends on the presence of that primary caregiver. That caregiver leaves the facility. The whole ambiance of the facility and the level of care is very dependent on that person. So it becomes a trickier proposition to advertise that which is good than to note that which is bad.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Do you have any further questions, Representative?
Madam Chair, I'll save mine and talk to the agency privately.
Okay.
I don't want to take many's time up here.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if we go back to the Budget and Management Division presentation on page 2, I was mentioning why this budget is complicated, and I'm going to try and keep this fairly short. Primarily, there's two reasons. The one is that the majority of the money that is sent to the long-term care ombudsman is matched with two different federal funding sources. The first one is eligible for Older Americans Act funding, which is a capped federal grant for long-term care ombudsman programs in each of the states. That money originates with the Department of Human Services and is then sent across the long-term care ombudsman, but is a capped grant. The second issue is that the services provided by this agency are also eligible for Medicaid funds, so for administrative funds under the Medicaid program. So additional resources beyond what's required for the Older Americans Act is also able to be sent over to the Department of Human Services, matched with federal funds on that side, and then sent back and received by this agency as other funds. So, for example, of that roughly $600,000 of general fund that you see there, only about $30,000 of that general fund is actually used on the underlying program. The other $560,000, is pass-through money that goes to the Department of Human Services, matched with Medicaid funds or Older Americans Act funds, and then sent back. So if you talk about the operating budget of this agency, it's closer to the $1.5 million that you see under other funds. So when you get into the details of this, it gets very, very complicated. I'll try and spare you from most of that and just highlight what we're doing operationally to this budget. Page 3, you'll just see the breakout between general fund and other funds, which we just spoke about. Page 4, you will see, in essence, that there's a 7.8% increase in the total funds budget for this agency, but a general fund reduction of 2.3%. There were no major changes through the interim for this agency, and there was all of the major programs provided by this agency are continued into the 2003-05 biennium. This agency is one of the very small agencies that we spared from continuing the ballot measure 28 cuts. You will see that we did something slightly different than that I'll walk through a little bit later. If we had continued the ballot measure 28 cuts, it would have been a general fund reduction of about $45,000, a total fund reduction of about $80,000, and we thought, quite frankly, that was too much. So I'll talk to you a little bit later about what we did instead. There's only one program in this agency, the long-term care ombudsman. And you'll see on page 6 that 52% of the total funds budget of the $2 million total funds is personal services. The big key is that 28% of special payments that's simply pass-through money.
Is that pass-through for what purpose?
It is pass-through to the Department of Human Services that they match and then send back.
Well, that's
the pass-through to the Department of Human Services.
It's pass-through in return.
Pass-through in return, Madam Chair. On page 7, we start walking through the details of this budget. You'll see that they started with a total funds budget of about $1.9 million and $600,000 of general fund. There are two very minor changes in the second special session. And then there were some base budget adjustments that increased the total funds budget by about $200,000, but actually saved about $10,000 of general fund. Two issues again with that. One is that the Medicaid match was slightly better. The amount of match for the program, federal funds improved. And the second, the reason the total fund increase was so large is that in the previous biennium, there were a few positions that froze being unfilled. And the default in state budget lingo is that we phase them in at a low step in the budget system. When they actually filled those positions, they hired more experienced people. The difference in that is the fact you hired more experienced people to fill those positions. If I turn to page 8, Madam Chair, you'll see the series of essential package adjustments. You will notice that these are very, very small, $263 of general fund, $8,000 for inflationary increases and state government service charges changes. The two that I want to highlight for you is package 050. During the 2001-03 biennium, we used about $25,000 of one-time ending balance funds. Those ending balance funds, when we developed the budget, were not available, so we put the general fund back in place. And package 060 is simply the pass-through money for the previous essential packages that is required to be sent to the Department of Human Services and then sent back. So I won't get into the details of that because it's that complicated pass-through issue. What I want to highlight for you is the last point, which is on page 9, and that is how we've cut this budget. We've done two things. We've eliminated about $40,000 of general fund, but about only $25,000 of that is reductions in the actual program. Representative Bates, when we talked about previous budget, didn't like this. In essence, we cherry-picked this budget again. The agency, Meredith, is very good when she talked about being a taskmaster of keeping this budget very, very tight. We looked at where they are expending for the 2001-03 biennium, and we basically cut the savings they had generated internally in half and said live within that lower amount.
So they got penalized for doing good.
That's exactly correct, Madam Chair. As bad as that is what we did. The next piece is the $15,000. We realized that there was additional other funds carry forward from the current biennium into the next biennium. We asked them to use that other fund balance again going into the next biennium. Madam Chair, all of this was done so that we could minimize the amount of cuts taken by this agency so we wouldn't take the entire roll-up of the ballot measure 28 reductions. So this budget is even stretched farther than it has been in the previous biennium. And to make one final note, Representative Bates' question about how often we're able to visit adult foster homes, even if you assume that that quarterly reporting was happening in different facilities, you're still less than 10% of those facilities being visited on an annual basis. It take over 10 years on that kind of schedule to visit all the adult foster homes in the state. And that is a very significant issue. There simply is not the funds to keep up with the growth in the long-term care system. Madam Chair, if there's any questions, I can answer them, but I think it would be better to turn back to the presentation.
Senator Shill.
Okay, this may be my really dumb question of the session.
You got a drum roll on that.
I wasn't looking, but I know it was Westland. On page 6, you say the special payments are 28%. And you call them special payments because that's money that you took, sent over to DHS, and then they sent it back. When it comes back, it's personal services, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, that is correct. It ends
so I'm looking at 28% and 52.3% and wondering, is this counting money twice, or is this a really dumb question?
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, in essence, you are counting about $570,000 twice of this budget.
So is the budget $2 million or is it $1.4 million?
The operating budget of this agency is about $1.5 to $1.6 million.
Okay, so it isn't a really dumb question.
No.
And that's not a $2 million.
You have
no, it's not. You have
some of your priority dumb questions still out there for you.
Hey, I'll use it later. Thank
good
you
luck.
Very much.
It was not a dumb question.
Well, I mean, so it really is this not I don't want to say deceitful, but you're sitting here and you're saying it's a $2 million total funds budget, but it's not.
It's,
you know?
1.5.
I know. So why are we calling it on page 6 a $2 million total fund budget?
I think they said that that's something about the paperwork of budgeteers or fiscal, I don't want to even use the word manipulation, but it's that kind of process that they've been used to be creative in finding revenue inside of this building that didn't exist when I was here 30 years ago.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but when it's a $1.5 million budget, to call it a $2 million budget, just it's not going to make it, as far as I'm
concerned.
Madam Chair, if I can clarify, the reason we have that is very simple. The federal government requires that they have one state agency that they send federal funds to. That is the Department of Human Services. And then the Department of Human Services has to bill. You saw the same thing with the Insurance Pool Governing Board. They have to bill these small agencies in order to get the pass-through that the federal government will recognize it. But it is a double count.
So we can blame the federal government.
What a novel concept.
And Chair.
Representative, I can tell we're going to have fun today. Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. George, first, I thank you for the clarification on the adult foster homes. I mean, you're really talking, if you try to do it on a routine basis, it would take you 10 years. You'd visit those homes once in 10 years. I also have to know that when you get the complaints, you get in there and take care of things, too. That I don't want people who walk away at the building thinking that we're not looking at this. It's just that you don't have the personnel to make those visits. I mean, not even quarterly, not even annually. You have to wait for complaints. And my concern is most of those have 3, 4, 5 residents and few people visiting them, and the likelihood of abuse is probably higher there than anywhere else. It's very hard to get there, and I understand that.
Madam Chair and Representative Bates, the other thing I should tell you is that in some areas of the state, for example, Central Oregon, I mean, every facility is covered, every foster care, every RCF, and so we have pockets of places where we just have an amazing number of volunteers, and you'll see all of the foster care covered. The biggest place where we have problems is Multnomah County. They've got over 600 foster care homes, and with all the other types of facilities, it's a nightmare in terms of getting routine coverage.
So, Madam Chair, I actually have a question I was leading up to.
Representative Bates.
Older Americans Act funds are 75-25% match, but they're capped. What's the process for capping? Is the federal government capping on the basis of number of beds, or what's the
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, I am not exactly sure how the cap actually works and how it's distributed. I think that they allocate a certain amount of money for Older Americans Act for these specific pots, and then they distribute it, I would assume, on a per capita basis. Mm-hmm. I'll check into that.
Meredith, you mentioned that Multnomah County. What's the history in Marion County?
Madam Chair, you mean the history in terms of adult foster care home coverage? Do we have that chart that tells what our coverage is? We could easily tell you what the history is, and if you want that, we can get you.
Can you get me Marion and Polk counties?
Surely.
And how successful we are at recruiting and training volunteers and how active and engaged. We are concerned about the issue and your ability to access that. I think that I know the majority of the members on this panel are concerned that the whole issue of abuse among the elderly, whether we're talking about the adult foster homes or assisted living facilities, and we understand the impacts and the implications. Also, you know, having to look at how much are you having to do and how much the protective services have to do. You know, those two pieces, I don't think you can separate, you know, that work activity of the two of you. You know, we looked at those stats of theirs. It was just like it was going out of the roof. And you ask yourself the question, how can staff, you know, actually really go in and do the job that they're being asked to do?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, all I can do is thank you for your interest in this area, and I can't tell you how pleasing it is to hear the Budget Committee interested in these issues in the way that you are.
I have some for the committee members. Thank you very much. You did very good, no acronyms.
But, Madam Chair, you know they're in my heart. So. Here, my dollars aren't going to make it into.
You know, I think the little one actually accepts a lot more. You have to fold it over. Oh God, you are good at stretching. Look at that. members, these are some concerns that we had talked about before, and that we're passing on information from Care Oregon on the Oregon Tobacco Quit Line that Senator Gordley had raised, and you get a response from that, and also the issue on individual health care benefits. And so I wanted to pass, we were supposed to pass them out on Wednesday, I believe it was, because on Thursday I was en route to Philadelphia. And on Friday you guys had constituent days. I must say that my trip to Philadelphia on health disparities was a very good one, and it's kind of interesting because we had our agency to talk to us about health disparity, and I have to say that Oregon, in our true fashion, in some cases was ahead of some of the other states. That's not to say that we don't have work, particularly in the area when we start talking about HIV, AIDS, the issue of diabetes, and the issue of asthma. And those were the general topics of discussion, particularly as to how we're going to educate our communities and our population to begin doing a better job in these areas of health that have become really huge issues in our society. So it was good dialogue between other states, and hopefully each one of us gave each other some ideas that we can use when we come back home. But it is one that I think across this country that we're going to have to address, recognizing that there is not the dollars to deal with strictly in Dr. Bates' side of going to the doctor, that as we're going to have to begin taking some control over our own health issues, which means that maybe the salt intake and the sugar intakes and I learned, didn't I?
You did. You got it down.
I got it down. And the exercise is very beneficial to us in the future.
Lifestyle.
Lifestyle changes is what we heard. And so anyway, if there's no further questions, tomorrow we will have before us House Bill 5030, Human Services, and that's department-wide support services. I've received a lot of questions from individuals as to when we're going to begin work session. We still have, before we get into work session, the rebalance, and we're waiting for Department of Administrative Services and Human Services to get those documents to us, and I understand you're working on those as we speak.
Madam Chair, we actually received the rebalance letter on Friday.
So we need to complete that, and then we will get the reshoot, and then from there we will begin work session, just so I can tell you where we are in the budget process. So,
Madam Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Did we not have public testimony from any of the...
No, but if you'd like to, I'd schedule some time. And if there's individuals, then we have time. If there's individuals who would like to come and talk about and to present testimony to us, we would certainly welcome that. It's a rare occasion, I have to tell you, when this committee is at a 2:45, and we're still here.
And Madam Chair, while we're waiting to see if anyone wants to testify, would you like me to explain to Senator Shields why that is not creative accounting, how that 500 and some odd thousand got double counted, and as...
I believe that Mr. Naughton did explain it, and if you explain it, it will take us too much time, and I do want to hear... I think we want to hear from individuals if they're in the audience and wanted to present their case to us.
But Frank might understand it if I said it.
I doubt that, so just let it.
It looked like there was someone who wanted to testify.
Would you just come up to the microphone?
I'll be happy to distribute.
Okay. Well, that's fine. We will have you distribute. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to, on behalf of the committee, to acknowledge the volunteer efforts. And I did a quick calculation. And if you factor in the cost of the agency personnel extended to the hours volunteered, that's an amount equal to approximately $761,000. So it's no small sum to point out to the committee in terms of what this program is doing and leveraging people's compassion for others. So thank you very much.
And I think with that, you know, since we do have time, and I would like to recognize all of the volunteers who are there, and I would like for this committee to give the volunteers out there a round of applause.
Yeah.
And with that, we are adjourned.
Oh.